49 to St George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said.
Welcome to Radio Free Kannada. It's Kevin Annett, your host, and it's April the 19th. Welcome back to all of our faithful listeners. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern at bbsradio.com/Radio Free Kannada. This is the official voice of the Republic of Kannada, established on January 15th of this year under common law as a new legal jurisdiction, independent of the Dominion of Canada, the Crown of England, and their laws. You can follow our work at kannadarepublic.ca and itccs.org. With me today is my co-host Ryan Daniel and our guest Andrew Patterson. Andrew's an old-time friend and comrade in this long battle. He's calling from the west coast of Kannada. He'll be calling in a few minutes. Andrew wrote to the Canadian Revenue Agency to simply inquire whether his money was being used to conceal genocide in Canada. Since he'd read a number of our websites and seen the hard evidence that that seemed to be the case, he was threatened. They actually never answered his question, but they, in the course of number of correspondences, threatened him, put a lien on his property and wealth and other stuff. And so he's going to talk about him going up against CRA over the simple matter of trying to abide by international law and not funding a government like Canada, which has committed war crimes and is covering it all up. So Andrew is going to help carry on this whole debate about criminal agencies like Canada Revenue, which is defrauding people all over our land. And we're going to be having a number of other guests over the next few weeks talking about how they've been leading that fight. One of them, Teresa Harrison, we have an important message about what's happened to her this last week. As you know, Teresa was one of the original signatories to the proclamation of the Republic of Kannada on January 15th. She also was instrumental in getting Dean Clifford out of jail. And just a day and a half ago, she was assaulted by two RCMP officers at her home, actually harmed physically, and arrested and booked. Now, we're going to, she's out of jail now, and we're going to have next week's show devoted to what happened to Teresa. I'm not going to say anything more right now, but it is obviously connected to the effectiveness of the work we're doing and the way that some of our most prominent people, including Dean and Teresa, are being targeted. So that'll be next week, April 26th. Please tune in for that and for ongoing discussions about the campaign against Canada Revenue and other fraudulent agencies. So let me just bring in Ryan. Hi, are you there, Ryan?
I am, Kevin. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Welcome back again. It's good to have you here. I know one of the things we want to do, besides having the first part of the show with Andrew talking about those things, is looking at the general issue of how and why criminal regimes like Canada, how their institutions can be nullified legally, and some of the evidence why we should be doing that. And I know you have the whole interest and specialty in the cultic aspects of these crimes, and we're going to talk about more of those today. But just so to remind people listening in, if you go to itccs.org, the latest posting, you'll see a public reclamation order that came out this week from the Provisional Council in Winnipeg, and it basically authorizes people to seize the property, the assets, and the records of these convicted criminal bodies, the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches in Canada, because of the hard evidence they're sitting on showing not only how they tortured and experimented and killed children, but how they're continuing to traffic these children. And we have, again, hard evidence of this listed right there at itccs.org, but we're going to be talking today about the nuts and bolts of how we go about doing that. So, Ryan, let me just, before Andrew comes on, let me just ask kind of a general question. One of the sources of information we've had of getting this evidence about, for example, the torture and murder of children at the residential schools in Canada is through something called remote viewing. And could you just tell the listeners what exactly that is and why it's a credible form of investigatory, an incredible thing that police and others use to investigate crime scenes?
Yeah, well, as you know, and as many of the listeners know, on my show, The Secret Teachings, no topic is off limits. So I've covered, everything that you can imagine, basically. And on one episode of another show that I host called The Last Frequency, I had an opportunity to interview a man named Courtney Brown. And he is one of the lead, I guess you could call, researchers of remote viewing. He did a really, really detailed remote viewing study with two of the world's most prominent remote viewers on the subject of what happened on September 11th, 2001 in New York City, Washington, and Pennsylvania here in the United States. So that's what we talked about. But remote viewing is much different than most people think. When they think of remote viewing, they think usually some type of like science fiction-y, you know, maybe they're hooked up to a chair, wires coming out of their head. It's not actually like that. It's more of a projection of consciousness. It's more of a type of astral projection, if you will. That's how I've kind of seen it, rather than actually a type of you know, device that you have to access or some type of advanced technology. What remote viewing is sort of, and this is about all the information I think I have on it, it's sort of like if you've ever watched that movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats with George Clooney, that was based off of a real governmental research project into the idea of remote viewing. The military during the 1990s, during the Gulf War, they wanted to be able to determine the location of certain weapons or chemical, biological weapons. They wanted to determine where enemies were located, but do it from a remote location, obviously, which is why it's called remote viewing, where a subject kind of puts them puts themselves in that position of whatever location that they're looking to do an investigation or do a study on. And the key point about remote viewing that really was intriguing to me is that when someone is put into a situation to do remote viewing, they are not told of the subject that they are supposed to be viewing. They are not told of what they are looking for. They simply go into the state of remote viewing. I'm not really sure how to explain that in any more basic detail. And then from that state, and I've seen a lot of this on video, this done from the beginning, it's incredible how they're able to give specific details of whatever the investigation is trying to find out. It's pretty incredible, Kevin.
Well, in fact, it's another state of consciousness and brain frequency, and we do have some information on that I want to go into a bit later in the show. I was just notified that Andrew is on, so let's just hold this thought for a little bit and after we talk to Andrew.
Sure.
Andrew, hi. Welcome to the show.
Good up. Thank you, Kevin.
It's really good to have you on again. I knew this is the first time you've been on Radio Free Canada, but you've been an often frequent host on and guest on my other shows, so it's good to have you. I wonder if you'd explain to the folks what happened between you and Canada Revenue Agency. I think it was in 2011 when you took your stand with them.
A little earlier than that, in fact. You know, that's perhaps when things came to a head. But I believe back in July 2010, I sent a notice. I served a notice, in fact, on the Minister of National Revenue, and started out by saying that essentially information had been brought to my attention that led me to believe that Canada, the Corporation of Canada, or the government, and or its agents, whatever way you want to look at it, had been involved in acts of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and other heinous activities, and also the so-called covering up, the concealing of the facts of these crimes. And being prudent and not wanting to implicate myself, that is, now that I'm in possession of these facts, I'm probably subject to penalties under international law, specifically the Rome Statute, Article 25 of the International Criminal Court, and essentially saying, you know, if I continue to support an institution that commits these acts, then I could be personally liable for fines and or imprisonment. And in order to do away or, you know, cancel my liability, I was asking for the minister's personal assurance that any funds that I remitted to them would not be used to commit any of these crimes. We all know the list. And that if he couldn't give me the personal assurance within a time frame, then essentially this notice would become the contract that he was admitting that that was, in fact, what the funds would be used for. and his agreement that I would be violating international law if I continued to remit funds to Canada, the CRA, any of its agencies, and so on and so forth. So essentially what I created was a conditional acceptance that I didn't refuse to pay. I'm not a tax protester. I'm not protesting anything. I'm simply saying that I believe that in order to be in accord with international statutes, in particular the Rome Statute, to which Canada became a signatory in 2000, as recognized, and I believe it's the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Act here, that essentially that's my obligation, that's my lawful and legal obligation to not support criminal organizations that commit heinous crimes, to not do so knowingly. And I've had a number of CRA people talk to me over the years, and usually I go through some of the evidence that you've collected in the work that you've done over the decades, Kevin, and other evidence of ongoing crimes, whether we're talking about the, you know, NATO destruction of Libya, for example, which was led by Canada in the first 3 months of that so-called operation. You know, it really, to me, at the time, seemed a very straightforward and obvious perspective. Here we are almost 5 years later, and, you know, certainly anyone that stopped and looked at it logically has to agree. I'm trying to remember the professor's name down in the States. He essentially took this position a couple of years ago, and we corresponded for a bit. It'll come to you in a moment.
But that's a question, Andrew. What happened when you wrote the initial letter Canada Revenue? What was their response or lack of it?
Oh, the minister wrote back, and essentially their position was that the intent of my letter was not clear. And that's usually how things are dealt with. They pretend confusion.
It kind of delays the process, too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and saying that regardless of whether they commit crime or not, that I'm still a taxpayer and I have obligations and so on and so forth. But essentially the party line, if you will. And that's all that was ever brought to me. And I would talk with the agents. They usually came two at a time and have a discussion. And they generally came to the perspective they could see why I was taking the action that I was taking and doing what I was doing, and that my beliefs were sincere, which is really the acid test of all of this. If I sincerely believe that giving money to people to commit crimes is wrong, and the law apparently backs me up, then logically there's nothing else that can be done.
So when the lady wrote about it says that in January 2011, CRA seized your company account, sent notices to your customers threatening with them being obliged to pay your alleged debt. Could you tell some of the repercussions?
Oh, at a personal level, yes. It's been destructive in terms of, you know, financially it was impossible to continue to conduct business because they essentially went after all our customers. Tried to make an example of us. My wife and I were in business at that time. In fact, we no longer are, and that's probably another consequence of, you know, taking this action. So I would say along the way that at a personal level, no, it certainly hasn't been worth it. And with regard to, you know, the overall effect, it's difficult for me to gauge, to be honest. As you know, I hosted a radio show here in Lake Cowichan for a couple of years, and this was certainly, you know, one of the topics that got touched upon. And I think what's of interest to me is how many people have looked at it and thought about it and done nothing. And that's
right.
I think the real question that we have to deal with is what stops people from doing what is, I believe, logical and essential, if you will.
Go ahead, Ryan. Yep.
I was going to say, do you think it's just complacency in the general population and this fear of what will happen to me if I do stand up?
Oh, sure. It's all of the above. I mean, it's the conditioning. That's clear. I mean, you know, what's it got to do with me? You know, this whole concept of limited liability, you know, that there are people who are hired to deal with these things, and therefore, you know, it's not something I should have to deal with at a personal level. That's, you know, that's why we have politicians. That's why we have bureaucrats. It's their job to manage these affairs. Don't trouble my my life with it, because it's not my responsibility. That's the standard kind of response we get.
So, Andrew, just so we're clear here, basically Canada Revenue said to you, maybe not in these words, but by their act, okay, it doesn't matter what international law says, pay up or you're in trouble. So in other words, they forced you to collude in a crime.
Yes, although in the end we didn't, because we did stand our ground, and we, I guess I had to abandon the bank accounts and so on.
So you didn't pay them anything?
No. No. No, we didn't.
Have they bothered you since then? Have they sent you any threatening letters or anything in the last little while?
No, no. The whole thing has settled down, and you know, that's that. I mean, that, you know,
right.
I suppose that could change, but on the other hand, you know, this thing just goes around in a circle, right? You know, they've taken all that they can take, and you know, with regard to taking this before court, well, you know, there doesn't seem to be much interest in due process at many levels here.
No, I mean, it's the same
thing. I found it interesting, too, how you got into this. I mean, after you read our website, actually, you helped create our website. I got to acknowledge you. You actually posted our book online, hiddennolonger.com. But when you asked the question of why don't people take action, what prompted you to take action?
I don't know. In retrospect, insanity. really? Again, I think I've answered that. It's the only logical thing to do if we're real. If we are who we say we are. To stand by and do nothing, you know, that's what children do. And I suppose that's the only thing that I can say about it is it's what separates us from the children.
Well, what would you recommend to other people? Would you recommend them to do the same thing you did and write a letter with the same statements, or will you have another option?
I didn't write a letter. I served a notice. It was notarized, and it was a bit more of a formal process than just a letter. And that said, first of all, no, don't do anything that I've done. I don't recommend it. What I would say is do your own investigation and study into what's going on and how things are run and organized. There's plenty of information available about that. And then do whatever you have to do to do what you feel is the right thing to do. In my case, it's to remove support from criminal organizations to the best of my ability. It's not completely possible to, you know, do that and function in North America, but, you know, to the best of our ability, that's what we have to do. Whether other people should do that or not, they have to look at their own conscience, and I suppose ask themselves the acid question: What if it happened to me? What if it was my family? You know, what if those are my kids who are taken away and never seen again? You know, what would I feel was the right thing to do to make sure that that practice was discontinued?
And one of the things we talked about, I remember one night, was the evidence that I'd been given by a number of the Native people on Vancouver Island about the Indian hospitals and what they had suffered there and been experimented on. People like Joan Morris, she was held for more than 12 years as a child in the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, actually just a couple of blocks from where I live. And you know, one of the things that went on in the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, I wanted to talk about in the latter part of the show, because it relates to this whole question of why people are so subordinated and can't really act on their own convictions. And, in fact, we have evidence about experimental programs going on to create through chemical and surgical means a slave populace, and how a lot of the research in the 50s to the 80s, especially, using prisoners, native children, foster care, kids run away from home and that, the whole purpose of this was to create the slave population. That was kind of the focus of a lot of the military research. So, you know, I do want to get into that in the second part of the show. I hope you'll hang around and be part of that discussion.
Well, thank you. Well, I hope that's covered. Any questions? I don't know if I've been completely clear in what you're looking for, but...
go ahead, Ryan.
What I have to say is we live in an extraordinary time, and the Internet has changed everything with our, you know, access to information. Ignorance is a choice. And I guess that's really all we're doing is separating the people who actually want to know what's going on and are prepared to do what's correct, and the rest of you are just going to go off the edge and wonder what the hell happened.
I think it's vitally important to understand the feelings and emotions of fear, and fear really drives a lot of people's lives, drives their decisions. Fear of what, you know, my friends are going to think, fear of what my family thinks, fear of what's going to happen to me if I don't pay this bill, if I don't, you know, go to work today, I'm not going to have money to pay my bills, I won't have money to take care of my family. It's just fear, 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 fear in a society of instant gratification, people buying things they don't need with money they don't have. And it just creates this vicious, vicious, vicious cycle. People, it seems as if they are worked to death as a slave population, I think, is even an understatement. I mean, we have really just become a group of worker bees that, you know, slaves is an interesting word, because slaves in the ancient world were actually different than slaves as we have today. Slaves in the ancient world were given some form of payment, if you will. It's a different type of slavery than we have today. Today, our slavery is based on how much money we can make and how much we can buy with that money. And then there's every institution, every person that has an ability to operate in a tyrannical manner, it seems, does everything that they can to just squeeze every last cent out of the people. And whether it's Canada Revenue or the IRS here in the United States, these organizations are established unlawfully. They operate outside the jurisdiction of what we consider to be the government. And like here in the U.S., the IRS now, guys, I don't know if you know this, the Internal Revenue Service, they have their own type of like police force now. They're able and allowed to carry guns for collections because people have become violent towards them.
Right. Well, it's not surprising. That's part of the pressure cooker that they're putting us in. You asked me what people could do. Here's a couple of ideas based on the fact that you're absolutely right. The face of slavery is continuing to change. It's becoming more ever efficient. So here's one. You can get people to ask politicians, bankers this question. Does the banking system practice fractional reserve banking? The answer is yes. And then you can ask them, in what way, could you please explain to me, in what way is fractional reserve banking not a Ponzi scheme? And the answer has to be, well, yeah, it is. And you have to say, okay, great, you've just admitted that you're participating in fraud. We can't move forward because once there's fraud, contracts are null and void, and on we go. So that's one approach if you want to have fun. Another one, try this
question,
one.
Andrew, what's a fractional reserve banking?
Fractional reserve banking is simply where you lend out a lot more money than you actually have available. That means if everybody came to collect their deposits at once, you wouldn't have enough to cover it because you've lent it out 10, 20, 50 times over.
Right, and banks are able to loan out. Go ahead.
Oh, and it used to be a hanging offense in the States in the 1850s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the act of usury is condemned by most cultures and societies. The act of charging interest on money that doesn't even exist, that's been looked down upon since the earliest days. And, you know, looking at fractional reserve banking, for most people that don't know, when you deposit like $100 into the bank, for example, the bank can then loan out a fraction of that money, 90% of that money they can then loan out. So I'd be able to loan out to you, Kevin, after I put $100 in the bank, they can loan out to you $190, 90 additional dollars that did not exist and never will exist. The fractional reserve aspect of that is they have to keep a certain percentage of it, about 10% in reserves in case people want to actually have access to the money. But if there was a run on the banks, there wouldn't be enough money, and the financial society that we live in today would essentially collapse overnight because there's not physical currency in circulation enough to pay off the debt that has been accumulated through the compounding interest.
And that's exactly
they make the
right.
Mafia look like school kids, eh?
Yeah, well, and to drive that home, that means that the current banking system is fraudulent because it will blow up. It's a mathematical certainty. It can't be avoided. Here's another one on much the same topic. Ask your banker / politician / agent, you know, are you familiar with the practice of quantitative easing? And Ryan, I'll let you explain that in a sec because you do a great job of driving it home. Quantitative easing, the process of creating money out of nothing, you know, the stroke of a pen to paper. Okay, if we can create all the money we need, trillions of dollars at a time, simply by signing a piece of paper, what do you need taxation for? Obviously, if you want to build something, a bridge, a building, whatever, you just create more money, go and build it. You don't need taxation. You don't need all these people. You don't need people stressed out. The answer, why do we have taxation? It creates scarcity. Scarcity creates value. That's what gives value to the currency, the fact that people are scrambling to get what there isn't enough of. It's musical chairs.
And I want to hold that thought. We're actually at the bottom of the hour, and it's a great lead-in to our song.
I'd like to do a song for you that I guess is about the greatest song ever written about America. And it's by Woody Guthrie. And what's so great about it is it gets right to the heart of the promise of what our country was supposed to be about. And I guess I don't know if you talk to some of the unemployed steel workers from East LA or Pittsburgh or Gary.
Yes, this land, this world is made for you and me, brothers and sisters, not just this land or fictitious nation state. So our purpose is to take it back at every level. That's why you're listening to the show, Radio Free Canada. Take what you learned and act on it. CanadaRepublic.ca, you can read more right there. You know, another song I really recommend for people to listen to, actually it's a beautiful poem by Langston Hughes, the black poet in New York in the 1930s. He wrote a thing which you can find on YouTube called Let America Be America Again. It's beautiful. It really applies to anywhere. Now, also, somebody called in. I just want to remind folks, we don't take calls unless you send in some notification beforehand. We want to work it into the program, and your questions and hopefully the things you're concerned about, we actually want to build whole programs around. So please write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com, if you want to be on the show or if you have a program idea. Okay, going back to the boys here, Ryan and Andrew, why don't you carry on what you were talking about? I think, Ryan, you were going to say something? Hello, anybody there?
Yeah,
yes,
we're on the
me?
Topic of questions that we can ask various people, and we're talking about quantitative easing, and again, the idea that if we can create all the money we want simply by, you know, punching it into a computer, why bother with taxation and all the misery and heartache and, you know, nonsense that creates?
You know, there's a couple of kids' movies, they're cartoons that depict this type of culture, and I think that there's a lot of stuff that we see in entertainment that can kind of show us a lot of I don't know what word I'm looking for, but a lot about how the world really is, because there's a lot of directors and writers who put this stuff into their scripts and make these into movies to try to promote these ideas. I just watched a movie the other day. It was a cartoon kids movie. It was called Nut Job. It was about a squirrel in the park, I think in New York or something, and he was looking for food, and then there was a group of other animals who were looking for food for the winter, and they were worried they wouldn't have enough food to survive. And it turns out that one of the main characters, who was kind of like the bad guy, if you will, what he was doing was getting rid of the food, and he was saying he got rid of the food because the less food the people have, the easier they are to control. The less food the animals have, the easier they are to control. And that's exactly what we have in our society today. There is a surplus of food, for example. There's a surplus of resources, but they are siphoned off and they are withheld from a mass majority of the population because, with what you said, when we create scarcity, it creates more of an easier way to be able to control people. And the financial system that comes into play with that is just a monster when it comes to creating things such as scarcity and keeping people in fear of not having enough to survive.
Sure.
Yeah, I find that same thing with one of the topics of the show today, of course, is the reclamation order that went out this week that said, under the law, criminal organizations, and you can check this out, it's a UN convention called the Convention on Transnational Organized Crime. Now, any transnational criminal body, such as the Vatican, which launders money for the mafia, which traffics in human beings, which is under international convention a criminal syndicate, you have the right to stop the flow of income into that body because it's going to use the money for criminal purposes. So you have the obligation and the right to go into the Catholic Church and say to people, not only should you stop putting money in a collection plate, but I have the right to take that money out of the collection plate and give it to the people who need it. And if a cop came by, you'd say, cite the convention and natural law and saying, look, this is a criminal body, and we, as with Andrew did with Canada Revenue, we can't be funding it. We're not obligated to fund criminals. And so this is a very powerful tool in people's hands. We're not just talking about the problem. We're giving you a means to stop it. But it requires taking that step over your own fear. And this is why we're putting out this reclamation order to say there's records in those churches showing where these children are buried, the experiments they did on them, and how they're continuing to traffic these children. And we're going to be going in and accessing those records with our common law sheriffs and that. So I want to put that out to the two of you to, like, kind of let's put this in a practical direction, this discussion about how do we get people to take that step? And any thoughts on that?
If you want to go ahead and go first, go ahead.
Well, you know, I think that's the question, right? What causes people to decide, yeah, you know, if I don't want to do business with HSBC because they admit and have paid massive fines, multi-billion-dollar fines, because they launder money for criminal organizations, why are they still continuing in business? Because people will do business with them. If you don't want these organizations to be in business, stop doing business with them. It's really straightforward.
Exactly.
Quite frankly, yeah, you know, if you don't want Coca-Cola to be in business, just, you know, don't, you know, go for legislation. Just don't do business with them. If everybody stopped doing business with them in 90 days, Coke would be out of business. It's simple.
Right.
So, again, back to it's the conditioning, Kevin. People have to awaken from their conditioning. Ryan, what you're talking about with the predictive programming is absolutely on the money. We see it over and over and over again with regard to, you know, we can see what's coming down the pipe because Hollywood is, its job is to show us. So how do you get people to wake up from conditioning and go, oh, my goodness, if we're going to, you know, have a future at all, it's my job to make sure it happens. Nobody's going to do it for me. You know, if you like, perhaps it's you know, about self-interest. You know,
I wanted to flag something for listeners. If you go to our itccs.org site, there's up at the top in the masthead, you'll see a title. It says Mass Graves of Children in Canada. And it's too long to even cite on the air, but I really need everybody to read that report. It's some of the hard evidence from eyewitnesses who describe how the Crown of England and the Church of England, who ran the first residential school in Ontario, the Mohawk School in Brantford, Ontario, how they went about destroying grave sites and records, showing that since 1832, that school had been a prime area where children were systematically taken and experimented on, sacrificed in the sub-basement catacombs, and really used as a child trafficking center. Bishop Bob Bennett in London, Ontario, and the primate of the Anglican Church, Fred Hiltz in Toronto, took a direct role in destroying that evidence. So here's an example of how these churches are actual crime scenes. They're actually sitting on evidence of how children are still being harmed, and yet, apparently, according to Leona Moses, one of the researchers for the Anglican Church, get this, there was an agreement between the Canadian government and all three churches, Anglican, Catholic, United Church, that if they took the legal and financial liability off them for the residential schools, the churches would have to disclose all of their records. they agreed to that, and the government kept their end of the bargain. They took the churches totally off the hook, didn't have to pay a dime in compensation or anything, but the churches never did. They sat on the records, and they haven't kept their bargain. Well, that to me is a criminal act right there. They're sitting on that criminal evidence. So this is one of the reasons that we're flagging this whole thing again, because we know there are people in a number of spots in Canada now who are doing the sheriff training to allow them to go in, open up those records, and stop those crowd, arrest those officers.
Yes,
Brian,
right there in black and white.
Yep.
Yes, right there in black and white for anybody to go see. I've witnessed it myself. It's really fascinating how the human condition really is when you show somebody the evidence. You can show them the truth. You can put it right in their face. And I know things are very interpretive. I'm a very dualistic type of person. But show somebody the truth in their face. And even when they see the truth, they have this belief system and authority, the father figure. And they listen to what we call experts and professionals. And if an expert of that professional, that father figure, tells them otherwise, even though they see the truth in front of them, they will, by a reflex action, reject the truth for what they will, in a sense, see the truth as the lie, and then the lie becomes the truth because the lie is being promoted by that authoritative father figure.
Right. Now, we mentioned right at the front of the show remote viewing, and I wanted to just talk for a couple of minutes about that, because some of the evidence that we came up with two psychics who we employed at about the time of the dig at the Brantford School. One of them had actually done remote viewing of the Nanaimo Indian Hospital. And she said, let me just read from the notes that she gave. She drew a picture of a human skull and showed an object being inserted through the nostril in under the eye to the base of the brain. And she said she kind of recited this other person speaking through her. She was some kind of channeler. And she said that this was a probe designed to separate the different lobes of the brain, separating the frontal from the midbrain area, in order to create a dissociated personality that would respond to orders but not be able to act on their own convictions. And there's a drug out called chlorpromazine, which anybody who's worked in the psych ward knows is used to control populations. It's really a barbiturate, and it freezes the higher functions of the brain. So they call it the zombie drug. And when I worked when I was training for seminary in Vancouver, I worked for 3 years as a psychiatric assistant. And these nurses and doctors are continually prescribing chlorpromazine for people. Looking at the effect on them, people would be sitting there in the day room who had been dosed up with chlorpromazine, and they would look conscious. And you'd say something to them, and they would respond very automatically. But if you asked them to think about something, they couldn't. And they couldn't act on what they knew. They were literally frozen. So that, to me, and this is getting kind of scary in a way, but if you look at the general populace now, that is a very accurate description of people. They know something is wrong, but they can't act on it. And I think there's more than meets the eye in terms of when we're talking about people's fear. It isn't just fear. It's direct control and manipulation. And I want to put that out there, Ryan and Andrew, for your own comments about that.
Well, it definitely is. Part of that has to do with, for example, radio frequency signals, the signals from your computer screens, the signals from your television, radio signals, Wi-Fi signals, cell phone signals. All of that has a lot to do with this, plus the food and the water that has been tampered with in a very purposeful way. The drugs that are pumped into the water supply, the drugs that are pumped into your food supply, the genetically modified foods, all of that plays a massive part. But so does the social conditioning and the getting of people to basically police themselves. And also, and this is something I know you're big on, Kevin, the etymological connection, the origin of words and where they come from, and how our language has really been so manipulated and oppressed that people don't have, even if they know something's wrong, they don't actually have the words to describe their feelings for whatever they're thinking. That's personally how I see it.
Big Brother, 1984,
yeah. Correct. That's what we were told, that eventually the language of dissent would be removed from the lexicon, that we wouldn't even be able to think in the terms of dissent. Huh. And that's what I think we're there. Yeah, one other element, it's very easy to dose people with the aerosol spraying that's going on, the geoengineering, it's happening heavily here on the west coast of Canada today, and has been for the last couple of days. It's easy to introduce drugs into the population en masse, and we've been told that this would happen as early as 1936, the movie, Things to Come, based on The Shape of Things to Come, where Freemasons of the air anesthetized populations by spraying them from above. They were based out of Basra in Iraq. Well, now the British have an Air Force base in Basra right now as we speak. So we've been told, we've been conditioned, that's called predictive programming, that all of this that we're witnessing now would happen. That's why people aren't in shock, because it's just science fiction coming true.
Yeah, that's right. It's also a form of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. I actually did a show on this recently about NLP, about how grocery stores and a lot of retail stores do the same thing. But grocery stores, for example, will put flowers at the entrance to the store, and it gives you a subconscious feeling that things are fresh. And, of course, you'll see the bakery typically right there by the flowers, and you'll see the words used like fresh. Baked bread, hot, fresh baked bread. And that gives you the mentality. I think researchers, from my understanding, have found that that lasts about 30 minutes in the store. So as you go around and you see, let's say, the meat, that even though one side of the meat's brown, the other side they've done something to it so it looks like it's fresh, even though it's starting to rot, you still think that's fresh because of your perception of what you saw of the flowers when you first walked in.
So, guys, let's talk about an antidote here, because we know historically, in the worst of times, the antidote always appears somewhere in the population, an alternative, a counter motion. And we have to find that within ourselves first. But I see around, and I do a lot of traveling, I see that counter movement building more and more, like an offshore tsunami. It is building in power. And just your thoughts about some signs that you see of that, some new hope emerging.
For sure, people are absolutely fed up from, one way or the other. They're not sure where to lash out, but, they've had enough. And everybody, when I met the RCMP sergeant here in town a few years ago for the first time, the first words out of his mouth to me were, "I don't trust anything the government tells me." 26-year veteran of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police saying he doesn't trust anything his employer tells him.
That's the Mountie speaking, folks.
Yeah, there's a man who's committed to getting his pension. I won't name him, but, at least he was honest with me, if not himself. So, what can you say to people there? Say, okay, so you're in a relationship with people that you don't trust. Is that healthy?
You can say
I don't know. What's it going to take? Because the reality is it's not just fear. People are benefiting. People are drugged. People are conditioned. People are starved. If they're eating GM food, they're starved for food. The Romans used food and fine-tuned their control of the population with food. It's nothing new.
That's right. Control. What's the famous Henry Kissinger quote? Control oil, you'll control a nation. Control the food, control the people.
Exactly. I find that when people are talking about resistance or breaking free, it's not even so much as fighting this system, because it seems to be that a lot of their actions are an indication that they know it's going down, that they know, like in many ways the system is on automatic pilot and the elites are getting out. We have to stop worrying about taking over the system as just creating a new one.
Exactly.
What reclamation is all about.
Pay attention to how you use your cash. Buy the food, shake the hand of the person that grows your food if you're not growing it for yourself. All of these things count. If you live in a city, get out. On and on and on. Let's face it, the people in the city, they're going to wish they'd got out soon enough.
Right.
So, just ask people in New Orleans who aren't there anymore. Essentially, that's what's going to come down to is what you're able to bring to the table anyways. What we're seeing, I think, in the population as well, it's scary, is so much illness, so many people who have become dependent on the system because they are now incapacitated.
And then they fight to protect that system in several different ways, even though they know that it's hurting them.
Sure.
Well, here's something from another Vancouver Island resident, a brother, John St. John, who wrote this book about his years as a chauffeur on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. Now, for all you people who still pay taxes to the Canadian government, here's some of the things he mentioned in the book and in conversations. It's a standard policy for all chauffeurs to be running the limousine all day long outside Parliament so that the member of Parliament doesn't have to wait 10 minutes for a car. Cost $5,000 a day so that they don't have to wait 10 minutes. Taxpayers paying for hookers for visiting diplomats up to $15,000 for 1 week. Of course, he had to sign a confidentiality agreement as part of his job, so he wouldn't rat on these people. But, you know, he told me an incident where he drove these diplomats to what's called the Club de Cirque and the Café Henri Berger in Ottawa, where these politicians, Canadian politicians and cabinet ministers, were paying $5,000 for a meal and $12,000 for a bottle of wine. You know, I mean, this is what you folks are funding, and as well as the debt to the banks. And people say, why? How can we stop paying taxes? How can you not stop paying taxes?
You know, that's the same thing with the big bailouts here in the United States. A lot of the heads of AIG and the big companies, the big lenders, after they got the first initial bailout of hundreds of billions of dollars, they bought a fleet of private jets. They took those private jets on a big vacation, prostitutes, $1,000 plates, $10,000 a night for hotels. Then they come back to the Congress and ask for another $700 billion. And people think, well, we have to have these institutions or the world's going to fall apart. The same thing all over the world in every country on this planet.
Got about 5 minutes left, just to flag that. And also for people listening in, don't forget, next week we're going to be talking about the attack on Teresa Harrison by the RCMP, and also this continuing saga about the campaigns being launched in a number of the areas of the country against the Canada Revenue Agency. Go ahead, guys. Any final thoughts?
Well, you know, there is lots of positive going on. It's up to each individual to look in the mirror, decide for themselves how they're going to proceed, and do that. You know, there's some things that nobody else can do for you. You have to do it for yourself. All the information, all the support, all the possibilities are there. People say, what can we do? Look at Iceland, for an example. They put their prime minister in jail. They hired an ex-cop, gave him 100 assistants. He's flying around the world, picking up the bankers, bringing them back to Iceland, putting him on trial, and putting him in jail. So it's possible.
Right.
Pay attention to those examples and pay attention to what turns up in your own life and take appropriate action. And as for fear, false evidence appearing real, you know, if you're still working from fear, well, you know, okay, you got some work to do, but get over it.
Right. Best antidote to fear is think of that child tomorrow who's going to suffer and die if you don't take action. Empathy is the, you know, love, empathy, consciousness, and education. We fight back, you know, with our reason and with our hearts. And we got to be organized, too. So go to CanadaRepublic.ca, join the movement, folks, and
Stand in truth. How's that? Take heart and stand in
truth. Yes, exactly. Ryan, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I'll just close with what I typically say at the end of my show, The Secret Teachings, and that is do the research and do the math for yourself. Stop letting other people tell you what to think and try to connect the seemingly unconnected dots between people, places, and events in the world that seem so complex will actually begin to make a little bit of logical sense.
That's right. And also a final message going out to the folks in Ontario listening in. We are in the process of organizing a gathering of folks in London, Ontario, who want to take action on a number of the things we've talked about today. If you can, sometime over the last half of May, make that, let us know at republicofcanada@gmail.com, and there'll be a lot more said about that in the next couple of shows as well. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. I know an hour isn't a lot of time, but at least it's keeping some of these things alive and keeping us all connected. Follow our work at CanadaRepublic.ca and ITCCS.org. We often will post things at ITCCS.org more quickly than at CanadaRepublic.ca. We've had a few glitches with that latter website. But anyway, those two sites will lead you to the main work we're doing. And just in closing, we've got another inspiring song from last week of how we people in the past have dealt with the Crown of England. So I thought this would be a nice way to end. We'll see you all in 1 week. 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, at bbsradio.com/radiofreekanata. Stay strong, all of you.